it's going to be a global phenomenon, but the Arctic is sort of the tip of the spear in terms of the changing water chemistry.
The U.S. Senate looks at ocean acidification. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 17th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, record-setting cold settles over Fairbanks.
We had a record low at 6:29 a.m. this morning. It has broken the record of minus 39 that was set in 1969.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Senators representing states that border America's oceans heard a warning today about carbon dioxide and how it could have a deadly effect on valuable fish and crab stocks. They heard it from a University of Alaska Fairbanks professor invited to Washington to share his research. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
In a town where partisanship seems to rule, the senators concerned about ocean issues are bucking that trend and bonding together. The recently formed bipartisan Senate Oceans Caucus held its inaugural meeting Thursday in Washington. Both of Alaska's senators are members, and Republican Lisa Murkowski is co-chair, alongside Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Murkowski invited a professor from the University of Alaska Fairbanks to share his research about ocean acidification. Dr. Jeremy Mathis focuses on chemical oceanography at UAF. He says an increasing amount of carbon dioxide is going into the oceans, which is lowering the pH balance, making them more acidic. And Mathis says that's happening in the Arctic more quickly than anywhere else.
It's going to be a global phenomenon, but the Arctic is sort of the tip of the spear in terms of the changing water chemistry because the Arctic waters are colder. They can hold more carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide is ultimately what's causing the ocean to be more acidic. And so it's that and a few other factors that have the Arctic probably a few decades ahead of the rest of the ocean. But it is a sort of canary in the coal mine mentality of so goes the Arctic, the rest of the ocean will follow.
Mathis says the acidification caused by carbon dioxide can hurt the ocean's tiniest organisms, which in turn has a ripple effect up the food chain.
There's the direct impacts from ocean acidification that can disrupt the biological and physiological processes of shell-building organisms, so clams and crabs and the commercial species that we think of. And then there's the secondary effect where the ocean acidification disrupts some of those smaller level organisms, the microscopic zooplankton and phytoplankton. So it's the things that the larger species are feeding on that if you disrupt that prey source for those larger species, then that sort of indirect effect could have an impact.
One of those larger species is salmon. Mathis says pink salmon feast on a small snail or pteropod, which acidification could hurt. He does not yet have direct evidence that the pteropods are declining, but Mathis says fossils show that past periods of acidification, even on smaller scales than what's happening now, had hugely harmful effects. Even though acidification is caused by carbon dioxide, Mathis says he's staying out of the politics surrounding where it's coming from.
I try very hard to steer the discussion away from climate change and some of the more hot-button issues and just treat it as a simple chemistry problem. There is excess CO2 now in the atmosphere and in the ocean, and that CO2 is causing a quantifiable, very definitive physical change in the ocean.
Mathis addressed the group of ocean neighboring senators behind closed doors in Thursday's briefing, but Senator Murkowski says she hopes to have future talks open to get them more attention and interest. Murkowski met Mathis in Fairbanks a few months ago and was so interested in his message that she reached out to him to present his research to her colleagues. The senator says she appreciates what she calls his rational approach to the science.
Do we need to sit up and pay attention to him? Absolutely. Is it something that we're all going to be leaving the room saying that the sky is falling and we're not going to have a crab fishery next year. No, I think the message is a strong one, and it's one that as policymakers we need to pay attention to, and that's important to us, but I think that it does make a difference in how the message is conveyed.
Murkowski says one of her takeaways is how strikingly different the national attitude toward exploration of the oceans is compared to exploration of outer space. She says there's far more financial, scientific, and technological investment in space than there is for the world's waters. The Senate Oceans Caucus was formed in the fall along bipartisan lines to bring energy and attention to issues ranging from economics to the environment. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska Native and environmental groups are back in court challenging Interior Secretary Ken Salazar's conclusion that a 2008 petroleum lease sale in the Chukchi Sea off Alaska's northwest coast meets federal environmental law. Shell spent $2.1 billion on Chukchi leases and hopes to drill during the open water season next summer. Salazar last month said the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management had corrected flaws noted by a federal judge in a lawsuit. Earth Justice Attorney Eric Graffy says that federal scientists acknowledge big gaps in what they know about Arctic Ocean basic features. Graffy says Salazar has incorrectly concluded he didn't need the information to open the Chukchi to petroleum development. An Interior spokeswoman says the department has no comment. Damaging winds earlier this week knocked power out for nearly 10,000 customers around the central Kenai Peninsula. Crews were still at work today to bring the grid back online. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has more.
Crews from the Homer Electric Association were at work again Thursday, restoring power to the approximately 800 customers still without electricity following damaging winds from a storm earlier in the week. HEA spokesperson Joe Gallagher says as many as 10,000 homes were without power at some point since the storm hit the peninsula on Monday. He says with winds in excess of 45 miles per hour, damage to the grid was to be expected.
When you see wind at that level, there's just no way to avoid power outages. The trees come crashing into the power line. They do a lot of damage. Broken poles, cross arms on the poles are broken, wire down, thousands of feet of wire had to be replaced.
The outage encompassed a large portion of the Central Peninsula, affecting about 3,800 homes around Sterling, 500 homes along both Chikansky Road and the South Miller Loop in Nikiski, plus another 1,200 near Bernice Lake and around 3,000 homes and businesses in Kenai. HEA is still determining the total cost of repairs as a result of the storm. Gallagher says they anticipate that number to be more than $1 million. He adds that HEA's budget does include room for such events.
You need to expect that you're going to see storms, especially in Alaska, so it is part of the budget situation.
With so many residents without power for the last 3 days, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management set up a shelter at the Kenai Armory. Emergency Management Coordinator Eric Mormon says residents have been resilient, taking care of themselves and each other.
There was a lady disabled, somewhat older. Her house was getting very cold. She didn't want to leave her house because she's worried about freeze-ups, didn't have a lot of resources. And someone went and helped that lady, although we could offer her shelter, we couldn't offer her something to correct her house. But while we were trying to find some private resources to help, some good-hearted citizen went in there and took care of it. And that's what really makes a difference to me, is that neighbors helping neighbors, watching out for other folks, lending a hand when they can, and working together. And I think that's really shows the Alaskan spirit.
He says just one person showed up at the armory Wednesday evening.
Most people are pretty self-reliant, or they will go to relatives or other facilities. Occasionally we'll have more than that. I think our past history is that we've had like 25 in the past. But the thing is, you never know.
The shelter at the armory has been closed, but Mormon says it can be reopened if necessary. The next step will be determining if the storm constitutes issuing a disaster declaration, in which case HEA could be reimbursed with state or federal funds. Gallagher says they hope to have power fully restored by the end of the day Friday. In Homer, I'm Shailen Cochran.
HEA spokesman Joe Gallagher now says the remaining outages on the central Kenai Peninsula will likely persist into the weekend. Fairbanks has set another daily low temperature record earlier today. National Weather Service technician Allura Weimer says the thermometer at the airport hit 41 below zero.
We had a record low at 6:29 a.m. this morning, and it has broken the record of minus 39 that was set in 1969.
Fairbanks also set a daily low temperature record Tuesday and just missed a record Wednesday. There could be more record-breaking days ahead as the forecast through Monday calls for 25 to 40 below zero lows. National Weather Service meteorologist Ray Little says the cold is the result of a ridge of high pressure that's pulling in Arctic air, and there's minimal relief in sight.
In the near future, which would be, say, in the next week, there's very little that we can see on the horizon that might warm us up. We could get a few clouds in here, but we're expecting that not to warm us more than a couple degrees.
Little says higher elevations are warmer as an inversion sinks the coldest air into valleys. He says it's hard to predict how big the temperature spread will be day to day, but the inversion is strong.
We're probably not going to break the inversion. And this will allow ice fog to develop under the inversion, as well as pollutants start to build up.
Extreme cold means more wood, coal, and oil burning, upping fine particulate pollution at ground level. The Fairbanks North Star Bureau has issued alerts due to declining air quality. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a group of scientists is opposing industrialization on the British Columbia-Alaska border.
This isn't just another piece of northern bush. You know, on a continental scale, this is just incredible.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
George Amawok is contesting the outcome of the special runoff election for the North Slope Borough Mayor. Charlotte Brower won the election. The final tally was 1,022 to 960. Amawok filed his notice on Tuesday, the same day Brower took office. He lists seven grounds for contesting the election, including missing ballots and recording discrepancies.
There are inconsistencies and irregularities in the whole process, and the final numbers kept changing every day, different versions every day, and it just doesn't balance out.
Amawok's campaign contends the election should not have been certified until the discrepancies were cleared up. On his campaign website, Amawok says, "I don't have reasonable faith and confidence the voters' will is upheld." He says he's not convinced all the votes were counted.
A good example is several of the ballots in the villages are missing. Where are they? They've signed in, but where's the ballots?
The borough clerk did not agree to a recorded interview. The new borough attorney also refused to be recorded, but said she is assembling an independent team to investigate the election. The Alaska Public Offices Commission late today rejected a consent agreement announced this morning between the commission's staff and Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell. The staff had filed a complaint of campaign finance violations that stemmed from irregularities found in its review of year-end financial reports filed for the 2010 election cycle. Associate Staff Attorney Martha Tanzik said the sticking point was in the value of services provided to Treadwell. APOC staff was not able to determine whether charges for an individual's editing and marketing skills were commercially reasonable or were a blatant violation of law. This morning's settlement, already signed by Treadwell and APOC Executive Director Paul Dauphine, would have required Treadwell to pay a total of $6,704, part of that amount of fines for not disclosing errors, and part as the cost of APOC staff time in investigating the complaint. The rejection by the full commission sends the complaint back to the staff for further investigation to determine the exact status of the issues that were initially questioned. Music. Alaska and Canadian scientists are among a large group of experts hoping to convince the British Columbia government to study the cumulative impacts of proposed development in the transboundary region. In a letter sent Tuesday to BC Premier Christy Clark, 36 scientists say industrialization spurred by construction of BC Hydro's Northwest Transmission Line threatens the area. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander has more.
The 287 kilovolt Northwest Transmission Line will stretch 214 miles north from the Skeena substation near Terrace, British Columbia. The BC Hydro project will provide reliable, economic power to communities and resource development. The power line has touched off what Dr. Jim Pojar of Smithers, BC, calls a gold rush mentality in the transboundary region. At least 11 mines, coal bed methane, and 18 hydroelectric projects are proposed for the Canadian side.
There's no complete assessment of what could happen if all of them get developed, you know, within 5 or 10 years.
Pojar is one of the scientists who have signed on to the letter. They say the Stikine, Iskuk, and Unuk rivers, important to both sides of the border, are the most vulnerable. To the north, the scientists believe the Taku River is already threatened by the existing Tulsiquitchief mine at its BC headwaters. It's an impressive list of PhD-level scientists. Dr. Jack Stanford of the University of Montana at Missoula is among them.
That's a very broad cross-section of the scientific expertise of the United States and Canada.
Stanford says that should carry some weight with the politicians.
If it doesn't, it just means that the disconnect between science and government is more profound than we think. We want them to listen to this.
The scientist's letter requests a transparent ecosystem-based approach for assessing new development in the transboundary watersheds. Pojar says it's the sum total of the projects that have them worried. While environmental impact statements will be done for individual mines, no one knows the effect of 5 or 10 mines in a region. A forest ecologist, Pojar has spent a lot of time in the transboundary area. He says big chunks of the watersheds are still fearsomely wild.
This isn't just another piece of northern bush. Sometimes we who live up north kind of take it for granted, the landscape we live in, but, you know, on a continental scale, this is just incredible.
The transboundary rivers support all 5 species of Pacific salmon that sustain Alaska and British Columbia commercial sport and subsistence fisheries. Dr. K.V. Koski of Juneau has studied Southeast Alaska's rivers, including many years on the Taku. The habitat restoration specialist spent 30 years with the National Marine Fisheries Service at the Auk Bay Lab.
All those transboundary rivers basically are the same type of system, you know, and they rely on so much of the wood and debris in those areas for forming the habitats and maintaining the channels and the sloughs and things like that.
Koski says hundreds of thousands of salmon rear every year in the lower Taku River in Alaska.
The majority of the juveniles actually come downstream from the Canadian waters and rear in the United States side. So it's really important that those habitats are protected.
Stanford calls the transboundary rivers the primary salmon producers of North America.
And most of them are entirely intact, not influenced by much of any activity other than harvest of fish. And thus, they're the last best places for fish, particularly salmon.
The BC Environmental Assessment Office is responsible for evaluating mining, energy, and transportation projects for the province. A recent Auditor General's report indicates the EAO is erratic when it comes to monitoring and enforcement. If that's the case, the scientists say, the BC government cannot assure environmental protection at the headwaters of the transboundary rivers or downstream in Alaska. They say even if only some of the proposed development happens, it could transform the ecological landscape of the region. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Fairbanks City Council passed a resolution this week encouraging the legalization of industrial hemp production. Growing hemp is illegal under federal law because the plant is a relative of marijuana. City Council member Lloyd Hilling sponsored the resolution to support hemp as a viable agricultural crop for Alaska. Hilling told the council, hemp has a lot of valuable uses.
It's fibers for a myriad of cloth-type products and rope and canvas and And, of course, the seeds for oils, it's used in a lot of different foods and even potentially for fuel. And then the herds, the center of the stalk, which is an extraordinarily good fuel. It competes with wood.
Hilling says hemp is grown at similar latitudes in Canada, and the United States is the largest, world's largest hemp importer. During public testimony, Lance Roberts questioned the council's consideration of the hemp cultivation resolution, considering no farming is likely to happen in the city.
I don't really think this is city business. I don't think this is anything that the city should be involved in. This has nothing to do with the city.
Robert said legalization of hemp growing is an attempt to get a foot in the door by people who really want to grow marijuana. Hilling countered that the crops are very different and said that development of hemp agriculture in the broader region would lead to jobs and wealth that would benefit the city of Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Last weekend, storms have complicated efforts to eradicate an invasive species of tunicate that's living in Whiting Harbor near Sitka. An aquatic farm structure in the harbor was scheduled for removal the weekend of the storm, but the more than 60 mile an hour winds that moved through Sitka on November 12th prevented crews from working that day, and the storm damaged the floating farm. Tammy Davis is invasive species coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
High seas and high winds definitely broke apart the farm. Some sections really just getting destroyed as it crashed up on the shoreline, the causeway shoreline.
Whiting Harbor and much of the infrastructure inside it have been infested with a species of tunicate called D. vex or Didymnum vexillum. It coats anything in its path, destroying habitat and preventing mussels from feeding. The Whiting Harbor outbreak is the first time D. vex has been discovered in Alaska, but other states, including Washington and Oregon, have spent thousands of dollars to prevent its spread. The storm's damage to the farm definitely has caused problems, but Davis says because the winds were out of the west, the structure stayed in the harbor system.
That is the silver lining indeed. The direction of the wind was the lucky piece in this story. Instead of things moving out of the harbor, they were moving into the causeway.
Things didn't go quite as well at the end of October, Davis says, when a piece of farm escaped the harbor and crashed on some nearby rocks. Most of it has been recovered, but that some small floating pieces might have washed up elsewhere. She urged members of the public to be on the lookout for buoyant debris that might have come from the farm at Whiting Harbor.
Especially if the debris has any sort of yellow or orangey white growth on it that might be the tunicate.
The cleanup of Whiting Harbor is expected to continue through the week. Davis says she's thankful for all the assistance so far, especially from the U.S. Coast Guard, various government agencies, and even local concerned citizens. The Bristol Bay Red King crab season is pretty much over, and fishermen are saying it beat their expectations. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
10 years ago, a Bristol Bay Red King crab fisherman could head out for 3 or 4 days and come home with a year's salary in his pocket. After the fishery was rationalized, it seemed unlikely that was ever going to happen again. Until this year. When the season started, things weren't looking good for Bristol Bay. The quota was cut by 47% this year, and the preseason abundance survey showed a continued decline in crab stocks. Some crabbers were predicting this would be the last opener for at least a few years. But as the season progressed, things started looking better. To start with, fishermen pulled up a lot more Red King in each pot this year than in recent seasons. The 3-year average is 20 legal crabs per pot. This year's preliminary number is 32, or almost 40% more. Fish and Game Area Management Biologist Heather Fitch says it's hard to say why the catch rate was so much higher.
You know, I wouldn't really want to speculate on that. Could be that crab were just in
areas where they weren't in previous years. I heard that from a few members of the fleet, which could have to do with the temperature over the summer. You know, it could have to do with maybe the population's doing better than we thought. You know, there's a lot of things that play into it that I couldn't really speculate as to exactly why we're getting such high catch rates this year.
Captain John Hansen says he did notice boats were finding crab in places they hadn't before, but cautioned that the reduced quota is probably padding the numbers.
You know, if everybody else was catching twice as much, I'm sure by the end of that, it would look pretty skinny.
Bill Prute is skipper of the Silver Spray. He says the area he fished seemed to have an abundance of crab, even with multiple vessels picking it over.
We set pots back four times and still had good catch rate in them. And some other boats fished in that area, left, and new ones came in and still had good fishing. So it just looked like there was a good abundance of crab.
It might be hard to say how much influence the reduced quota had on the catch rate, but it had a pretty straightforward impact on the price. Crab broker Rob George says the final dock price is going to be around $10.50 per pound. That's almost $3 more than last year and a new record for the fishery. That would seem like a good thing, but skipper Bill Prute says the higher prices make him nervous.
You know, it's nice to see a high price, but there's always some repercussions. It's things too out of line, and it just kind of throws the balance of things off, I believe.
Balance is something crabbers talk a lot about these days, both in terms of money and fish. Here's Captain John Hansen again.
Ultimately, the bottom line is that the way this fishery is run now, that everybody is vested in this industry and they want to look after it to where we can fish every year and not go to this boom and bust cycle like it used to be years ago.
That balance can be a hard thing to achieve with a dynamic resource. It's still up in the air whether the fishery will be closed next season. Area management biologist Heather Fitch says it really depends on the results of the federal trawl survey that happens each summer.
The survey data gets plugged into a model, and that's what we use to determine the total allowable catch each year, and that's where we get the relative abundance indexes for the fishery.
And sometimes that survey is at odds with what fishermen see out on the grounds, as was the case this year. So really, it's hard to say what the future holds for Bristol Bay. While the Red King season might have been unusually short, fishermen will probably face the reverse situation when they go after snow crab in January. The quota for that fishery nearly doubled this year to almost 90 million pounds, which means it's unlikely any boats are going to have a one-trip season for snow crab. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Ed Bronco in Sitka, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. If you receive Medicare, the time to join, switch, or drop Medicare prescription drug plans is earlier this year. It's between October 15th and December the 7th. Every year, plans change and your needs change. To find the Medicare prescription drug plan that's best for you, call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 1-800-478-6065. That's 1-800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.